Welcome to the Do Good to Lead Well podcast. If you're passionate about mastering self-leadership, then you're in the right place. I have always been curious about and fascinated by the pursuit of leadership excellence. This is why I pursued my PhD in psychology with a specialization in business, and I've continued to dedicate my career to understanding the science and practice of positive leadership. My name is Craig Dowden. I'm a best-selling author, award-winning keynote speaker, executive coach, and member of the Forbes Coaches Council. Each week, I'll bring you world-class content on the science and practice of positive leadership. Through my conversations with best-selling authors, TED speakers, and top CEOs, you'll be able to leverage their insights and experience so you can maximize your potential and be the leader the world needs you to be. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Do Good to Lead Well podcast series. I'm your host, Craig Dowden, and it's an absolute pleasure to welcome you here today. I'm really excited to dive into this conversation. And before we get started, for those of you who are return visitors and live attendees to the VIP webinar, welcome back. Awesome, as always, to have you. And for those of you who have joined us for the first time, fabulous for you to be here. And I'm also thrilled to share that the podcast is now ranked in the top 0.5% of podcasts globally. And that cannot have happened without your ongoing support and your feedback. And so thank you very much. And the primary reason why the podcast continues to grow such a following is because of the amazing guests like Catherine today. And I'm going to touch on the bio. There's so much more I could share. Catherine Tremblay is a Canadian entrepreneur and business leader with over 30 years of experience specializing in the human aspect of human resources. As CEO and co-founder of Altus Recruitment and Altus Technology, Catherine has steadily grown her organization into one of Canada's largest privately held recruitment and staffing firms. Born and raised in Ottawa, Catherine's entrepreneurial journey began there in 1989 when she launched a small staffing firm with her co-founder and late husband. Little by little, they grew the company organically, expanding to the GTA and Vancouver as they encompassed more niche industry sectors and areas of specialization. Today, the organization has offices in Ottawa, Toronto, and Vancouver, and as a remote by choice employer, over 200 team members across Canada working to place more than 8,500 talented candidates in meaningful roles every single year. And last but not least, Catherine was named the 2021 CEO of the Year by the Ottawa Business Journal and the Ottawa Board of Trade, and has been recognized every year since 2006 for running one of Canada's best managed companies, the Platinum Club member by Deloitte. Catherine, so awesome for you to be here.
Well, thank you, Craig. I really should just listen to the bio as told by you, that awesome voice. It kind of makes you feel like really special. I hope I can just tell you before we start that you're someone who does really bring people together. And it's one of the most important qualities that you bring. You're not afraid of making introductions. And it's a really great quality. And you've introduced me to great people, and learning about you and seeing how well you're doing with your podcast, your book, but also that great network and community you create. Really beautiful, Craig. So kudos right back at you.
Oh, well, thank you. It's kind of mutual admiration club here today, because I love the energy that the community and the forum attracts. And I think that I just feel privileged to be a part of that and to be able to participate and contribute in that way. And the Do Good to Lead Well podcast is exactly an extension of that. And one of the reasons I was so excited, so there were many reasons. Your entrepreneurial, your leadership journey is incredibly inspiring. And I'd love for you to share a little bit about how you got here and the lessons that you learned to start our conversation today.
Gosh, I'd love to spend the whole day just chatting with you about this, because it's a fun story. You know, I actually was born always wanting to carry a briefcase, Craig. Okay. I was that kid who was just really into, you know, how do I get a job where I'm sitting at a desk? Anyhow, 16 years old, my mom finds an article, like imagine the old school days of an ad in the paper, and says that this company, a staffing firm, is looking for a receptionist. I mean, this is serendipitous, I think. So my mother says, look, here's my red suit, get on the bus and go to this interview. And sure enough, you know, with all her coaching, I ended up securing the position. And working staffing 4 to 5 years, I did payroll and recruitment, and they put me on the road and send me by bus to a complaining customer. I mean, you name it, I was doing it. And learned a lot really with the hard knocks. That company was going to be closing, you know, just for different reasons. It was coming to an end. And it was a time when I did find there were great jobs out there. So I started by thinking, I'll start a funeral home. Maybe I'll put some little funny special treat objects in cereal boxes, tried to develop something there, which didn't end up coming through. Then it was like, what if we did real estate with this kind of certain perspective? And then finally, we were like, you know, I had met Tony at this staffing firm. We said, why don't we just start what we know, build some capital, and then we can start that funeral home. But sure enough, as soon as we started this firm, we were so hooked, and we did start really tiny. I mean, he worked in an apartment downtown. We borrowed a car from a friend, so we would go interview people at their house. We would actually honestly save paper clips because we didn't want to have to go to any kind of store and buy them. So we were really, really careful. We had no money. The Royal Bank lent us $7,500 on a youth venture loan because we were both under 23 years old. And, you know, we just really started that way by borrowing money from friends. And then what we learned the hard way and the quick way was reinvesting in ourselves. And so throughout all of that early journey was just putting every penny back into the business. That was kind of those early foundation years. I mean, this is 35 years ago, but I'll never forget it because these were challenging times, but so exciting too.
No, and that's amazing. The firm has grown so much, so substantially over the years. And I actually have a question from Tim, who was in, sounds like in a similar space in terms of wondering, so that journey to expansion, as you were looking at, because you opened up offices across the country, now you have a national footprint, what were the decision markers that prompted you to do that, and any lessons or insights about how to make that most effectively, or what to avoid?
Well, you would ask me about lessons. Yeah. And I mean, that was one of the questions in the first one that I probably didn't get to, but the lessons of the first year were that it was sheer hard work and just really reinvesting our capital into retained earnings so that we had money from which to grow. And so our first goal was to be the largest staffing supplier to the federal government. Once we achieved that goal, then this question from Tim was that only once we reached that goal did we then say, okay, we're in a position that we can now start the next office. When we started in Toronto, the decision was really that without the GTA, it's hard in Canada to be anything. And I just want to just kind of go there. 42% of the commercial business in Canada occurs within the GTA, and it might even be 43 or 44% now. So with Ottawa being a 6, 7, 8%, we had to supplement. So when we went to Toronto, we started into the provincial government, the government of Ontario, private sector, nonprofits, and really built gradually. Once we achieved one of the largest positions in private and Ontario government, we then said, okay, let's go to Mississauga, because Mississauga was all the much more supply chain and almost like a very different kind of manufacturing client. We expanded there. Once we saw that was achieved, then we started in North York, in Calgary and Vancouver, in order to keep kind of almost like supplementing geographically and then supplementing by skill and industry. And so that basically today, it's really interesting. We're about a third federal government, a third broader public service. We're talking, you know, all the everything, universities, hospitals, and then a third private sector. And so when Tim's question, what I love about it is like the why and the how is that we always saw that no matter what, with a recession, high economic times, low economic times, that if you have different types of companies and organizations and sectors served, plus different geographies. And one more thing to add to that was both temporary contract and permanent. That with all of that matrix, that in high and low economic times, we would always be able to fluctuate and really survive and grow no matter what was happening in the economy.
And thank you. Fantastic answer. And one of the things that I'm reflecting on, Catherine, it sounds like there was almost an intentionality behind every decision point. So it was, okay, let's get our foundation solid and then start to strategically think about, okay, how do we expand that, be it either geographically or service or client? Is that an accurate assessment of
well,
that?
Well, it is and it isn't, Craig.
Yeah, great.
Yes, it's accurate in that we were very intentional in our growth plans. What was less intentional was that sometimes things didn't work as well. We found that our footprint in Calgary was more challenging. And still to this day, you know, we're now looking at maybe an acquisition in that space because we were very much about growing organically, strictly from ourselves, reinvesting in the business, growing slowly. But in some markets, we might need to do a little bigger and different push. and really relook at our strategies. So some of it's intentional, some of it where we've seen a little bit more challenge, we might have to challenge ourselves to rethink how we expand because they're not all equal.
And I think that's such a great point, and for all of us to reflect on, is that sometimes things just don't work out no matter how well thought through, no matter what's going on, and then having that ability to pivot and adapt to that reality. And so I think that's so powerful. I've got another question, not surprised, from Kevin saying, congratulations on all of your success. An extraordinary story. And just interested in what were some of the challenges and some of the lessons that you've learned as you've built this organization almost from your basement to where it is today?
Oh, I love that question. Thank you for it. There's so many lessons learned. I'll start with lesson number one was really about saving cash. And I know I said it before, but I want to reinforce it only because it's one of the reasons I think that we've done as well as we did is that because we constantly reinvested, when times were tough, we always were able to rely on cash. We found that by saving and saving to a point that we never had to rely on any kind of borrowing, put us in a position that we could make better decisions and sleep at night. The second thing was that we have very close relationships in our workplace, almost like a family, like we're really aligned to each other. The issue I would say there is that over the course of the business, I had to learn the distinction between friendship and family, but that this is a business and it has to perform. And that journey of going from friendship to high performance was a journey that I had to learn. And I think most people listening to this who are in business are thinking the same thing. Oh yeah, like I really like this person, but does it mean that they are performing for the business, right? Third lesson I would say is that I think mental health was really taboo. I don't know if you would agree, Craig, but it really was a subject that when I started, if somebody said they were depressed or that they needed more light in their office, I'd be like, what? what does this mean? And I think you know, Craig, that I have four daughters. And in the journey of having children, I saw that my kids had all sorts of different ways of coping with the world. And that depression or seasonal sadness or all sorts of anxiety or any kind of issues in our entire space show up. And it allowed me as an employer to recognize that every person has individual needs from which the way we manage them, the way we communicate with them, but the way we honor the work that they're doing. And so the lesson there was just really understanding and accepting the individuality of each person. And I think that's been a big lesson. I don't care how large the company becomes, that the importance of every human is really key.
Well, and I love that. And I think you're absolutely right. I would wholeheartedly agree that mental health has become much more commonly talked about, and rightly so. And there's a light shone on that. And I love the focus that you put, Catherine, on that humanity or the human element, because we are all, regardless of the organizations and where we work and what we do, we are all human beings. We share that. And integrating that into the day-to-day and really learning from each other, that's so powerful. I've got another question. These questions were a rapid fire. Anna was wondering, what were some of the transformative moments that defined you as a leader or as an individual? What were those?
Thank you, Anna. That's a beautiful question. You know what I like about these questions, Craig, is that they actually almost light up how we feel about ourselves and we explore, right? We almost go back into our own history. So thank you, Anna, for that question. Well, there were several pivotal moments for me, okay? But I'm going to say one was becoming, when we first got in 1995, they used to rank us in the government. And when we saw that we were number one for the first time out of 79 staffing firms, I remember the elation of realizing that all the nights and hard work were actually really paying off. So that was a beautiful moment. The second I would say that was truly pivotal was that I think, I don't know if we've referred to this, Craig, but my partner and I met my business partner when I worked in my former company. We became business partners and then we became life partners and had our four children together. And he was diagnosed with terminal cancer in 2014. That journey of having to take care of him, try to save his life, see every doctor that we could possibly find, and really nurture him. He was diagnosed at a stage 4 terminal immediately. So there was a lot of care required. And in that context, I was also running the business. I also had four daughters of 7 to 17 years old. So this was a time, Anna, like, I don't even really know what to tell you. It was actually, you know, a fog to me. I was really just getting by. And a lot of people in the community from friends, clients, candidates really came together to support me. Even I remember coming home after a long workday to groceries on my doorstep, or having a friend sign up to help Tommy and to take care of him when he was sick. So in that journey, and then when he passed away, when you say, like, what were the pivotal moments? Well, there was his illness, but then there was when he passed away, and I had to really explore for myself what kind of leader I am. And what would it look like to not have a business partner? What would it feel like to not have someone to take on some of the things I didn't like? I recall having duties in my job where I'd be like, I don't really like this thing. I'd call Tony. I'd be like, I'd cajole him and say, Tony, can you take this thing that just landed with me? He'd be like, yeah, sure, I'll take it. When he passed away, and suddenly I had to be responsible for areas and issues that I had never really had to dig into. It was hard for me, Craig, honestly. And so that was a pivotal time where I had to re-become myself. And finally, Anna, sorry to make it such a long, but 35 years, lots of things there, was COVID. I mean, I hate even using the C word. I'm so tired of it. I know we're all exhausted from hearing it, but the pandemic shifted so much for us because we had multiple layoffs. We had to come together as a company to get everybody back to work. And then dealing with George Floyd's murder and recognizing our space in bias, in anti-bias, in really showing up for DEI was a massive journey that we went on. So in the 35 years, probably a really beautiful moment, a tragic loss, and then COVID. I think those are the things that I would put as the top three big ones.
Well, and thank you. And this is one of the many reasons I was so looking forward to this conversation, because I just appreciate the transparency, the authenticity, and how openly you share these things, Catherine. And they're very powerful lessons for all of us. Kathy has a question, a great question, and thanking you for being so open and being so transparent with your personal story and your tragic loss. And she says, it sounds like you've gone through a tremendous amount personally and professionally. So any insights and terms of how were you able to maintain that level of resiliency? How did you find the strength to persevere? So would love to hear your thoughts on that.
What a lovely question. I think resiliency is really interesting because we have to acknowledge that sometimes we have it and sometimes we don't. And I think sometimes leaders, you're on a podcast and people think, oh yeah, like you're so resilient and you're always resilient. Well, there's no always, right? Okay. Right. I'm mostly resilient, but I'm not always resilient. So in the mostly phase, I would say that something that has really supported me has been my optimism. I was a child, Craig. My mom, if I got up in a bad mood, would say, get back in your bed. I'm going to close your door. I'm going to put your blind down. And when I come back in here, I'm expecting a very different human to show up, because if this person is showing up, this isn't working for me. Wow. So my mom really taught me a lot about learned optimism. Mm-hmm. That we can learn it through gratitude principles, and really working on how we are showing up. And so I think that in resilience, I was able to rely on that piece. Secondly, I think resilience, and I know that everyone listening here would probably have had the same experience. Sometimes you have no choice. Mm-hmm. It's not like I had a choice to feed my children or not when Tony was sick and I had to run the business. Like, it's not like there was... Sometimes there is no choice. So sometimes later on, someone congratulates you and says, oh, you were resilient. But truth is, you were just putting one step in front of the other. And you weren't even really exploring whether you were even being anything, a good leader, authentic, like all the great qualities we can exude and we can tell people about. When you're in a crisis, you're just managing the crisis. Sure. Later on, you could look back and say, oh, I was resilient. Mm-hmm. Coming out of it today to work on my resilience, I lean on my children. I mean, on you and others in my community, business leaders that I can call when I need advice. I'm very comfortable asking for advice. Mm-hmm. And I'm not worried about what I don't know. When I was a younger leader, and I think the advice I would give to the person who asked this would be, you know, when sometimes as a starting leader, you're afraid of admitting what you don't know. But once you're at a certain stage of life, I'm 56 years old, Craig. Well, how fearful am I to really say, hey, I don't know this, or I haven't seen this, or I haven't experienced this. And somebody tells you a case study that they've experienced, a scenario they've solved, and all of a sudden they're shedding light on the problem and you're now able to use that. So it's not your resilience you're relying on, it's theirs. You know? Yeah. So I think a big lesson for me was that, yeah, sure, most of the time I'm resilient, but a lot of times I ask for help and I'm okay with leaning on someone to support me through the thing I didn't know. Resilience to me is just this constant oscillation of highs and lows. and you just go with it, don't you?
Well, and I love that. It's such a fantastic perspective on it and so many things there to touch on, because I really appreciate how you commented that it's not an either or, it's not an always, never, it's oscillating. And some days we have more and some days we have less, and recognizing that, I think that's very, very powerful for us all to understand and identify within ourselves. And I also really appreciate, because again, sometimes, and there's lots of great research around this, when we're under stress and we're feeling a bit overwhelmed, we can retract and almost withdraw from. And I love how you're highlighting not just the community, which I think is so important, as you're pointing out, Catherine, and then engaging and asking and leaning on, once again, so, so powerful. And I love that within your story. And lastly, the power of saying, I don't know. I remember someone, I forget who it was. There was a best-selling author I had on, and they were like, we were talking about the future and how to be successful. I was like, I think the speed with which you get comfortable saying, I don't know. so it sparked that within me when you said that. There's something so liberating. I remember someone saying, I learned the power and relief that comes with saying, I don't know stuff. And
yes.
Okay.
There's something else, Craig, that I want to add for that last point is that I found that during COVID, I started to participate in groups of leaders talking about issues, started reading, going back to some of my old favorite business books. I'd love to share them with you if you want to add them at the end of your podcast. There's some really good ones. And also participating in those who are researching and writing and advocating for new ideas. I found that once I started to put myself in a space of learning and not being so, oh no, I know this, I got it. No, I don't got it. I should have got to go back to the beginning and relearn this. I've even gone back to some old books and favorites to bring me back to a space of what is it that I need to bring to this? Like new learning that has really made a difference to me.
Thank you for sharing that. And yes, absolutely. I happily always recommended reading lists are fantastic resources for the podcast and for me. And I love how you're highlighting the role of learning. I think just adopting a philosophy of curiosity about life and about work is of paramount importance. And I love that you're shining a light on that, because that really enables us to be our best selves and to test the upper limits of our potential. So I think that's just fabulous. And there's a question I wanted to come back to, and I'm so happy you touched on it and in your journey, and you asked this really powerful question where you said, who do I want to be as a leader and who do I need to be as a leader now? And so I'd love to get into, so who are you as a leader? I'd love to dig deeper into that question with you.
You know, Craig, thanks for the question. Like, you know, when you think about leadership qualities and, you know, if we all kind of Google leadership qualities, it's like, do we espouse them all? And are we all of those things? And I think when I had to look at who I was being as a leader is that it all starts with me. Nice. And I don't mean a lack of humility or that I'm the only person, but that I'm taking accountability for what I bring to the company. And my accountability is that I'm strong in client engagement, revenue generation, creativity. I'm not that great at data and insights, and I need to rely on others to really shed light on, like, why was that number important and how did that affect this and what could we do about it? You know, I have found that in my leadership is being accountable for my strengths and being okay with those areas that I have either a weakness or a blind spot and asking the question, like, tell me about the blind spot, that what am I missing? So the accountability piece is that it starts with me, and that only when I can admit what I'm not comfortable with can I actually fulfill the blank and fill in the space. The second thing is gratitude. And I know we talked about that before about my mom, but, you know, sometimes when we have a dark moment, and let's be honest, it's when you read the news, you watch TV, I mean, come on, you know, we're all feeling a little bit of uncertainty in the world. The geopolitical situation is difficult. And yet, if we can exercise gratitude in our own life, did you walk outside today that you were safe? Did you have a great meal? Did you have a great chat, you know, on the phone with someone, or maybe a great fun text exchange? All the beauty that we have in our lives, if we can acknowledge it, it can give us a space of some optimism so that our space doesn't become dark and overwhelmed with all the darkness that might be exterior to us, but how we show up in gratitude for ourselves. And I'd say the third thing in leadership is around diversity and inclusion. And I find the word diversity, inclusion, these words are being somewhat overused And people are starting to roll their eyes when you say them. Truth is that diversity and inclusion changed my life. Because Tony, who was a Portuguese Brazilian immigrant, definitely struggled socioeconomically and struggled with a variety of items that came from his socioeconomic status. And he would share this with me. And yet I never fully understood his life experience. And as I got older and watched and explored, why is it that there are so few Black women in leadership? Where did they go? If they were hired, what happened that they weren't promoted? And when I started asking those really hard questions and showing up for diversity, not like talking about it like as a, you know, I'm going to post a LinkedIn thing about it. I mean, that I'm actually showing up in the space of diversity and supporting and lifting voices of anyone, religion, your race, sexual and gender diversity, learning abilities. Like once you start really listening and showing up, it changes how you speak. It changes how you perceive your children, how you interact with them. It changes how you behave with the community. And I think that that lens changed my cultural approach, and that cultural approach actually made me a better leader and mother. So it kind of did a full circle. Sorry, that was a really long answer, Craig, but that subject of diversity and inclusion really speaks to me.
No, and I love that. And to start with, because I'm with you 110% about great leadership starts with great self-leadership, not from an ego standpoint. And I love how you frame it, Catherine, within the context of accountability. And then how I'm showing up is going to impact the organization. Our moods are infectious, our actions. So all of that is so important. I really appreciate the emphasis on gratitude as well, because it reminds us that we have choices about what we're looking for in the world and where we're going to invest our time and what we're going to pick up on. And I love to me, and I'm also very passionate as well, and appreciate your observation. Because that's also important to acknowledge that sometimes diversity, inclusion, that there's the QI role, as you say. And yet what I think is so important, and you highlighted some of the challenges where it's not about posting, or it's important to ask tough questions. I want to get some more. I want you to unpack that a little bit more, because to me, when we ask ourselves tough questions, uncomfortable questions, that maximizes the chances for learning and insight that we can take, where we can take action.
Yes. I guess on the subject, particularly if you're asking on diversity and inclusion, is that I always thought that I was right and I wasn't. Okay. Mm-hmm. I thought, oh, well, we place Canadians from across the country. We place newcomers. We place everyone. I mean, obviously we don't have a problem. And then one of my employees, as I was walking home from the George Floyd protest, that was a peaceful and beautiful protest in front of Parliament Hill. And I was walking home from having been alone in the office during the COVID phase. And, you know, I'm crossing this police barricade and this team member of mine says, Catherine, what are you doing? And are you sure you're doing enough? I was like, oh, yeah, I got this. Oh, yeah, I'm doing this and this and whatever, you know, the classic defenses. And she said, but have you looked at our staffing process? Are there spaces where there could be biases? Are we advocating sufficiently for our candidates who might not have Canadian education, or perhaps they've just arrived in Canada? They have this gorgeous background, but we're not really promoting them sufficiently to our customer. When our customer says, no, not interested, they have an accent. Well, so do I have an accent, by the way, we all have an accent. But, you know, the client says that, we say, oh, okay, versus, oh, no, just a minute. An accent is just how we hear it. It doesn't mean the person can't do the job. They might be the most amazing person in this position. And whether their accent is British, African, Lebanese, Canadian, whatever, call it whatever you want. Whatever it is what it is. And so when she asked me the question, I had to do the deep work of looking at every part of our application process, to the screening, selection, presentation, advocacy, measurement. Once we had to do all that, we really did see that there were spaces we could improve. And in that improvement came a lot of really beautiful conversations with our clients, with our candidates, with seeing, I mean, some of the thank you notes are much more powerful than they were before. Before it was like, thanks for the job. Now it's like, wow, you know, I have a future in Canada because you got me started. Not that we only place newcomers, obviously, but there was a beauty in the work that we've been able to do in the last few years to advocating for newcomers that they can't advocate for themselves. And it's been pretty special for me to experience that.
Well, thank you for that, sharing that powerful personal example, because there are so many fabulous lessons in there. Number one, for me, the observation I have is, isn't that great that the person in your organization felt comfortable to ask you that tough question? Like, it says a lot to me about the safety about and the inclusivity of that environment. And the power that that can have is that we can be asked questions that are important for us to consider. And I love your observation as well in terms of how initially that, oh, no, it's all good. And then taking that pause and going, okay, am I, you know, to what extent am I living to the utmost limits and am I pushing things? I think that's just, again, for all of us, so important to remind ourselves. And again, I so appreciate your transparency, right? Where, yeah, you just react and you're, oh, yeah, I've got this. And then, no, revisit it, come back to it, yes. Think about it, reflect on it some more. It's so good. And I've got another question. It's great because you did talk about that not from a place of ego. And there's a question from Emmanuel on ego. I'm curious, what would be your best advice on how a leader should go about managing their own ego and other people's ego? There you go.
What a fantastic question. Thank you for it. Well, managing our own ego, let's be honest, that's a lifetime thing too, right? Because what happens when you become a leader is that people start to interact with you as your job title. And it can become very easy to start seeing yourself in your job title versus actually seeing yourself as really, are you showing up? If you're saying that you care about humanity, that you want growth, you want to thrive, but only with good measures of being a good human and a good employer. And for me, the most important thing in making a difference is to be a great employer. And if my purpose is to be a great employer, because that changes the world, right? Every great employer changes the world. So I care about that. And yet, sometimes, where does my ego come in? Is this about me, Catherine Trombley, or is this actually about the business being amazing, about all of our leadership being amazing, and then lighting something up for the future of our workforce that isn't about me, and distinguishing my identity from the identity of the business, and accepting that my shortcomings are mine and I own them, and I'm good with my short, like almost just, you know, accepting that I will not always be in this seat. We all have an exit. In some format, whatever the exit is, I lived that with Tony, right? So I want to be present to the business to make a difference to the business, but to recognize that I'm not it. The business is all 220 employees, all of our 8,000 candidates. That's the business. I'm just a conduit from which to create it. Now, managing other people's egos, oh my goodness, can we talk about that for a moment? This is an area that I'll admit is one of my biggest struggles. Every single week and every single day, something shows up for me where someone else's ego is driving their decision-making, is driving how they ask questions, is driving their behaviors. And sometimes it doesn't show up very well. And it doesn't always mean that it's aggressive. Maybe it's defensive. Maybe it's not listening. Whatever it is, ego shows up in a lot of ways. And supporting people through the journey of acknowledging where that ego is coming in to allow them to actually just be like, you're just you, you're Craig, I'm Catherine, that's it. We're just us. We have our good days, our bad days. We show up a lot of different ways. But when we bring our ego into it, it becomes a whole other conversation. You and I actually could transform this conversation by bringing our egos.
Yeah.
We really could.
Yep.
And so some of the conversations I do have that are difficult are when I feel I'm interacting with someone's ego instead of their true selves. And a lot of times, mostly the most important thing you can do, I think, is ask questions. Tell me why you're experiencing that. Where are you coming from in that thinking? And then through those questions, sometimes the person can see themselves in it and then allow themselves to get out and be like, oh yeah, there is another way of exploring this, or, you know, whatever, but you have to see where that ego is showing up.
Absolutely. And I love your point, and I couldn't agree more. The conversation can go in a totally different direction if our egos show up. And I also love how you highlighted, and there's fabulous research around this as well, how ego compromises decision-making, undermines the quality of decisions, and how frequently it happens where people are making decisions not on what's best. And I love how you highlight, okay, is this about me or is this about my company? Separating that space, because the ego can be, no, it doesn't matter where the company is. I'm just doing what's right for me. It's going to make me feel good. And that is the road to some pretty challenging things. And I also love, Catherine, how you talk about managing our own ego, which we all have. And it's important to have, for sure.
Yes.
It's a lifelong process. It's a lifelong journey. It's a skill. And the more we're aware of it and the more that we pay attention, the better served that we are. And I just love that piece and continued growth. So I've got another question, and this links to the vulnerability piece. I'm really happy that this came up. So Keith was saying, I want to take a little different tactic on this. I have an odd relationship with vulnerability because I'm worried sometimes that if I'm vulnerable or open or transparent, and thank you, Catherine, for exhibiting this so powerfully, that people aren't going to respect me as much, or it's going to show weakness. So what do you, any thoughts around that vulnerability weakness dichotomy?
Well, Keith, I think you're right. It is a dichotomy. And in fact, being a woman in business and showing vulnerability can sometimes be a double whammy because you're almost expected to be vulnerable. And then when you are, is it too much? Okay. That said, I work in groups with other CEOs, male CEOs, and I find the best CEOs I know are vulnerable. And I don't mean vulnerable like they're crying every day or that they're not that I'd mind if they did, but it's not that kind of vulnerability. They're just open to saying, I don't know. I need help. What do you think about this? Can you share your example? And the vulnerability can show up simply by just being yourself. And yourself could be you're an introvert, an ambivert, an extrovert. Yourself could be that you're, I don't know, that the way you communicate or what you seek in your life is different from somebody else. And vulnerability doesn't always have to show up. We think of vulnerability as intimacy and personal and fearful or crying. It's not that. Vulnerability is just the being our truthful self. And what I had to learn, actually, this is a difficult lesson, Keith, I actually am going to share this with you, is that I was raised in a highly performative family. And it's not because we had financial resources. We did not. My father worked, my mother did not, and we definitely struggled at home a little bit. But because my parents were so concerned that my brothers and I would succeed, there was always, you have to put a smile on, you have to behave a certain way, you have to look a certain way, you have to just be. And sometimes that standard was very exacting. I don't begrudge my parents. I thank them for doing this for us, but it was quite high. And that performative thing came out in me as I got older, and that sometimes I couldn't distinguish between, is this me or am I actually performing? And when I saw myself be performative, I could see that I actually didn't have an authentic relationship. I'll give you a super short example. I remember having a moment on the phone with one of my daughters that was not as friendly. Anyone who has kids sometimes knows they have an unfriendly moment with their child. And it was one of those moments that I felt a little bit sad and aggravated. And as I was leaving my office, I kind of had a long face. Like I looked like I was probably upset. And I ran into one of my team members. I just put a big smile on. It was the most fake smile you've ever seen. And the employee said to me, who was a wonderful person, a wonderful ally, said, what was that? Why'd you just do that? I know that you were having a moment. I don't know what the moment was, but you were having a moment and you don't have to put on that performance for me. That happened 10 years ago, by the way. And yet I never forgot it because when I see myself interacting with someone, if I see myself putting that fake performance thing on, I ask myself, is this actually vulnerable? And, or is this just me being like, wow, who is this? So the vulnerability piece is, I do have to be cautious of vulnerability as a woman in business that I don't show up excessively vulnerable. So instead, I just look at transparency and am I living to being non-performative and transparent about what I'm experiencing? So it could be good or bad. I'm just being transparent.
And I love that again, and great, some fantastic comments on this. And what I love is that it's even framing it. So that vulnerability piece versus transparency. So powerful to think about. And then also the follow-up question about, so how much of this is performative and how is this serving me or not serving me in the moment? And it's one of the things that I just admire and respect so much, Catherine, about you, not just the thoughtfulness and the openness and the transparency, also powerful reflection questions that you'll ask yourself and wrestle with, as you said, and across all kinds of domains. And it's not just when you're passionately advocating for diversity and inclusion and asking those tough questions, you'll ask them personally. And I think it's just wonderful when we do that and challenge ourselves in that way. And I've got a follow-up question from Tina, who says, this has been so inspiring. And I have to admit that I suffer from a little bit of, or a lot of, imposter syndrome. So any tips, thoughts, techniques around how to manage that? I'm really glad this came up.
Well, I want to acknowledge Tina, because I didn't know what imposter syndrome was. In fact, I was the person, if I heard it or saw it or learned about it, I'd be like, what is that? I don't know what they mean. Like, what is that imposter syndrome? And yet I have actually experienced it over the years. So when I received that beautiful award from the Auto Board of Trade and the Auto Business Journal for CEO of the Year, I was really honored. I mean, I probably fell over myself a few times. I was just like, wow, this is like a pretty powerful thing. And yet I started to doubt myself almost immediately, almost to the point where my palms were sweating. I was like, do I fit in this room? Do I match that profile? Have I done enough? Do I actually have a legacy? Because sometimes you hear people who've won awards and you're like, oh my gosh, so, you know, they've changed the world. Have I done that? And I started to actually self-reflect in a bit of a way that was negative about myself. And I actually did turn to a few of my coaches and mentors and just said, hey, this is what I'm experiencing. And they had to kind of bring me to an humble place, stay humble, but honor that award because it happened. It was special. Like, give it the honor that it deserved. But it doesn't change that every so often, I still have to question myself, like, oh, should I be here? Do I deserve a place at this table? Have I earned a place? And I remind myself that our earned place just comes from all of the lessons that we've learned. And the earned place does not have to be only about revenue. Maybe somebody else is a $1 billion company and I'm a $200 million company. That's okay. The $1 billion company doesn't mean they've earned a bigger place. It just means maybe they have a few more lessons or different lessons that it doesn't make me an imposter. So I honor the person who has said this because I know what that journey looks like. And I can't pretend that I've never felt it ever again. I do still experience it, except I can see it now. And so when I see it, I open that book, I look at it. Oh my gosh, okay, I feel it. And then deal with it and move it aside and get back to being yourself. And I've noticed that the more I'm just myself, the more people just accept me as I am without that imposter, like you're this or you're like, just don't put any qualities or qualifications to it. It's just, this is what I am. And learning, I'm going to add one more thing, Craig. When I had a business partner who was male, being my husband, his voice often trumped mine. And having to be a female leader and using only my own voice, acknowledging that I didn't always use the same language as he did, or sometimes the language of the entire room. A lot of times I'm in a meeting, all of the language sounds a certain way and I sound different. I used to try to change my voice and change even the words I used so that I would sound different, smarter, better or something. And I kind of accepted at some point that my voice as it is in the words and language that I use as a woman is okay. And I don't have to be an imposter. I actually can just be myself. And so accepting myself actually allowed me to get over some of the imposter syndrome by just accepting that my language is okay.
Well, and again, awesome, awesome comments, fantastic insights, Catherine, and particularly, and it's a running theme through the conversation today. What I really appreciate is when there are moments of reflection, pause, it's like, oh, okay. And then you just lean into the support networks that we have. You ask the question, you're transparent about what's going on. And I think that's so powerful because then it opens up support for us. And then, okay, and to carry on, as you say, another lesson learned, and there are people learning this different lessons, and that's okay. And I do want to come back. I'm thrilled you use this word of acceptance. I think that is just, there's so much power in accepting ourselves and accepting our circumstances, a whole other conversation we can have. I just think that's one of the most powerful words for every single one of us personally and professionally is to embrace the idea of acceptance and that I am enough and I've learned things that are valuable. And I also love as well, accept, and I'm going to hearken back to one of your previous answers because I thought it was awesome what you shared. I have strengths and I have certain development areas and we all do. And I accepted like this philosophy of acceptance. So I think that's just so absolutely bang on. So I've got another question. We're running to the end. I'm not surprised. The audience has just been very active as always. And I appreciate you acknowledging the power of the questions because this is why I love being a part of this conversation. My job is so easy. Tristan was wondering, given how much you consult across the country with top organizations in so many different sectors, curious about what are the key qualities that employers are looking for?
What a great question. Because what I'm seeing is that for a long time in my industry and for myself, it was always about the qualifications on their resume, which meant, you know, education plus years experience plus computer skills, you know, like very classic hard stuff. But today, because a lot of resumes look the same. Who's not using ChatGPT? Everyone's resumes sound the same, same verbs. Everyone's been coached on them. So the truth of the individual starts to show up as, you know, are they someone who communicates with diversity and inclusion? Do they have empathy? Are they able to show how they would problem solve? What is their creativity that they might be bringing to this problem? And, or can they admit, oh, I don't know that technology, but let me tell you, I'll spend the weekend learning it and be sure that I can do it. So what I see shifting, and we're just in the shift, is shifting from hard skills with a little bit of soft skills to absolutely all the questions you asked today about everything from, you know, creativity or innovation or resilience or problem solving. Those are the things that we're going to see showing up in our selection and interview process. And I would really encourage your listeners who are considering how they shift their career to shifting towards, if they're going to take a free course or a webinar or whatever, to really being okay with taking a course that doesn't look as metric driven. Sure, there's data insights and like there's all the things you absolutely have to know, but it's also beautiful to add something to your profile that is perhaps you did a course in design thinking so that you could think in a more interesting, creative design kind of way, right? So it would be great for the listener to think of valuing and honoring their soft skills. Whatever those soft skills are, they don't have to only show up with the hard and really do a beautiful blend of that.
So many things I love about the answer. And again, on the soft side of the equation and the human side, if you will, you talked about the empathy and listening and collaboration, all those fantastic things, is that this is something that's becoming increasingly important, particularly in the age of AI and how we can embrace that. And it's come out time and time again in the conversations that I've had across different episodes of this podcast. So only a couple of questions left. And I love this one from Henry, who said, you've just seen Catherine to have found a great group of mentors and people to support you. Any advice for finding a good mentor?
Well, actually, sometimes they find you. And I'm going to tell you, Craig and Henry, thank you for asking it. I said no to mentorship for a long time because I was intimidated that my mentor knew more, was stronger, better, or something. And because I did lack a little bit of confidence, if I was offered mentorship, I'd be like, oh, no, I got it. I got this. And I actually declined it for a better part of my career until when Tony got sick 10 years ago and I had no choice but to be like, oh my goodness, you know, this financial problem I have, how am I going to solve this? Or I have an insurance question or a tax question or a people question. I actually really had to rely on others. And when I saw that people were so happy to help that they didn't want anything in return and that this big circle of help was going around the globe and I was missing out, when I saw what I was missing out on, I realized that it was up to me to step on to the kind of merry-go-round of accepting help versus where I was before. So I really, in my career of 35 years, I spent at least 25 of them saying no to all help and all mentorship. And only in the last decade have I been absolutely, I've changed that completely. And so I think that is it about finding the mentor or as somebody shows up in our life willing to give us some coaching and they say, oh, can I help you with that? Or I have an idea. You say yes every time. Oh, yes, I'd love to book a 20-minute call with you. Let's talk about it. Ask, listen, be open. And you keep doing this. And suddenly, over the course of a year or two, you start seeing your mindset shift because they helped you shift. The mentorship came to you and you accepted it. But it's us that have to accept it.
I love that. Again, so many things. So great. Because once again, it's really shining the light on our own personal accountability. It's our mindset and it's how we're looking at those situations. And I really appreciate how you say, hey, so mentors can show up in our lives constantly. And then it's, do we take advantage of that situation where someone is offering us help? Someone is offering us insight and then taking advantage, leaning in, going, hey, and I can't figure everything out. I need assistance. Everybody needs help. Reminds me of this amazing quote by Barbara Fredrickson, one of the top positive psychologists. And I'll paraphrase. Essentially, it's none of us can be at our best without the rest of us. And I just love that idea because it's, well, inspiration, insight, valuable lessons come from all over. And then it's on us to create the conditions to be able to learn. Thank you. This has just been absolutely awesome. I knew it would be, and I'm thrilled. Considering that 2024 is around the corner, I would love to hear from you, you know, your thoughts on how can we make 2024 the best year yet? What's a piece of advice or some things that you would challenge our listeners to embrace so that they can start off the new year excited to test their potential?
I think I'd go really old school, Craig. Love your question, by the way. Someone asked me this the other day, and I thought of this old program I did where they asked the question, if we were a year from now, looking back on the year that was. So we're 1 year from today. What has to have happened for you to be satisfied? And so is it about, you know, walking more, cooking more meals at home, seeing your grandmother, your mother, your friend? Is it about showing up at work for 8 o'clock in the morning because that's your best time to be creative? Whatever it is that's going to land you in this space is being almost old school about setting goals. I think sometimes during COVID, it was hard to set goals. It was actually even hard to even hold ourselves to a goal. But at this point, COVID's gone. Well, not gone. Actually, people are still getting sick. But I mean, it's gone as in the epidemic of how we were behaving in the pandemic. So does this allow a new space to go at old school and look at the year ahead, work backwards to what does it have to look like? Set those goals, maybe measurements that might be every month. Did I walk? Did I see my friend? Like reasonable goals. And then as you achieve those, you start to kind of almost like pad your successes. And then it allows you to keep going. The other thing I would do, I think if I was looking ahead, is I would pick maybe one book or one podcast or something that elevates your space and make it part of your journey. So for me, one of my goals is to increase my podcast listening. I read a lot, but I'd actually like to spend more time listening to the voice of other people who are sharing things that are not necessarily about business. It could be about anything, but I have a few that have been referred to me and recommended, and I haven't picked up on it. So a goal is going to be to listen to one podcast per quarter. And so I'm starting to look at what that is and getting a little bit more engaged. So I think that whole old school goal setting is where I'd go in.
I love it. And what I really appreciate is projecting into the future, because we all have that capacity to do that, and then say, okay, so when I'm closing down 2024, what would make it a great year? And then start to think about, okay, what are the concrete steps that I can take and basically reverse engineer it? I think it's so powerful because it combines the visual with the practical. And also, as you said, it instills that confidence and that celebration of the achievements along the way. So this has been absolutely awesome. Thank you so, so much. Anything that we didn't touch on today or final nuggets you want to share with the audience? I just so profoundly appreciate the time we spend together and of getting to know you. Just love what you've shared today. So any final thoughts before we close?
No, I'm going to honor you one more time, because you know what, Craig? You bring yourself to it. It's really fun talking with you. And I think that when you have someone who's right there with you, alongside you, kind of asking you questions that matter, and your audience obviously has some really beautiful questions too, I think it makes it a really joyful experience. I'm going to add the last thing is I've been really studying uncertainty. Our world feels so uncertain right now. And I was leaning into uncertainty in a way that I think was making me unnerved. And there's the journey of uncertainty to anxiety, but then anxiety can become excitement. So what I've been working on for myself is every time I face an uncertainty, it could be with a customer, with a sector that's not doing as well, anything. And I'd say, what is the excitement? What's the opportunity? What am I taking from this? And really trying to transform that uncertain anxiety into excitement anxiety. And I'm not saying I've got the solution, but it's something that I've been really working on my trajectory. And I would encourage anyone listening who might be also looking around saying, wow, there's just so much uncertainty out there, you know, to really relook at it is how could you reframe it as excitement?
Amazing. I couldn't have mic drop right there. And I really appreciate, and again, couldn't think of a stronger close on that, whereby the energy is there. So you're in that uncertainty, and then that can be channeled in an anxiety invoking way, or we can, it's excitement. There's opportunity within that. And I love, and I think that's so powerful and something that I continually challenge and going to bring forward for myself as well as that. So what's my mindset? What's my frame? What's my reframe? So thank you as always for just being spectacularly fun and engaging and open and insightful. This has just been a real pleasure for me, And until next time, everyone, looking forward to you joining us on the next episode of Do Good to Lead Well. Bye for now.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you so much for joining me here today on Do Good to Lead Well. If you enjoyed today's podcast, please subscribe and leave a review. If you'd like to continue the conversation, you can follow me on Twitter at Craig Dowden or reach out via LinkedIn or email info@craigdowden.com. I look forward to meeting you here next week for another transformational episode.